I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. The civil war in Syria began 2 years ago, and today an estimated 70,000 people have died. Hundreds of thousands have become refugees inside their country, and many have fled to neighboring nations. The fighting and destruction continue, and now there are allegations that President Bashar al-Assad's forces have used sarin gas on rebel forces. President Obama had previously said that Assad would be crossing a red line, and there would be consequences if he used chemical weapons in what has become a bloody conflict. Here's what Obama said yesterday at a press conference.
What we now have is evidence that chemical weapons have been used inside of Syria, but we don't know how they were used, when they were used, who used them. We don't have a chain of custody that establishes what exactly happened. And when I am making decisions about America's national security and the potential for taking additional action in response to chemical weapon use, I've got to make sure I've got the facts.
According to today's New York Times, the White House is considering supplying weapons to Syria's armed opposition. Well, today on Radio Times, what are the options the U.S. faces in Syria, and what does crossing a red line mean after so much death and destruction? We have two guests joining us from the ISDN studios of the Center for American Progress is Brian Katulis, a senior fellow there. His work focuses on U.S. national security policy in the Middle East and in South Asia. Brian, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be back with you, Marty.
Also with us is Michael Noonan, director of the Foreign Policy Research Institute's Program on National Security, a former captain in the U.S. Army Reserve. He served in Iraq in 2006 and 2007. And Michael Noonan, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Well, thank you, Marty. It's great to be back on.
Nice to have you both with us. And Brian, if I could begin with you, what's the message that you're getting from the White House?
We need to be judicious here. We need to look before we leap. We need to make sure that we have our facts straight. And I think the second message is we're not going to go it alone. Whatever we may do next, because the U.S. has gradually been upping its intervention and its involvement in Syria, whatever we do next, we need to do it in coordination with as many partners as we can.
And what do you hear as the message, Michael, coming out of the White House?
Well, I certainly wouldn't disagree with anything Brian just said there. Unfortunately, one of the issues here is that the president on numerous occasions has talked about this red line, and now he's trying to kind of walk it back a little bit. And while I sympathize with that, unfortunately, we have other situations that are going on right now, in, whether it be in North Korea, or whether it be vis-a-vis Israel and Iran, that I think we really need to be, you know, we really need to find our facts pretty quickly here. And, you know, we should do this multilaterally if we can, but there really, I think, needs to be a consequence here if it's proven that the Syrian regime did, in fact, use chemical weapons.
Using Obama's words, talking about actions having consequences, he hasn't laid out specifically what he thinks the U.S. should do, but he did talk about a game changer, a red line. But it is important, it seems to me, to have the facts before moving forward.
Oh, yeah, certainly. I mean, one of the issues here, so in the New York Times today, it basically says that the administration now. I wrote a piece on U.S. News and World Report on Monday where I talked about five basic options for the United States. And it seems like the president has outlined option one, which is kind of status quo plus at this point. Before, we had used our intelligence services to vet certain rebel groups, particularly the Syrian National Council and then the National Coalition, to find some partners on the ground. And then we started providing them humanitarian assistance. So the White House now at least has, you know, at least hinted to the sort of the paper of record that we are going to escalate a little bit by actually moving to actively arming the rebels with weapons.
Brian, going back to you, how does one get facts on the ground in a place like Syria where there is so much fighting, there's so much chaos and at times confusion?
It's very difficult, and I think what the Obama administration here is doing in exercising all this caution is trying to avoid the sort of slam dunk scenario, if you remember the phrase used by George Tenet about Iraq's supposed weapons of mass destruction and nuclear weapons. And what's been done, and this story's been around actually for several months, the allegations of the use of chemical weapons. In March, the Assad regime was accused of using those weapons. The U.S. intelligence community found some strong evidence that sarin gas was used. Much of this evidence has come from Syrian opposition groups, and there's been more than one organization representing that they have more than one sample from more than one attack. But it does seem like the use was on a small scale. The Syrian government also contends that the rebels have used some form of chlorine gas. So there's a lot of allegation there. There's a UN team that I believe is seated in Cyprus right now that's been wanting to go in to try to verify. But because of Syrian government opposition and other things, we just don't have enough clarity beyond the fact that it looks like chemical weapons were used. By whom? Seems some elements of the regime. Was this ordered from on high? That's a key question that I think the administration is looking at, of whether the Syrian government made a senior leadership decision to use this, or whether this was some rogue element inside of the Syrian military forces.
But, Brian, I'm curious about why, I mean, as horrible as chemical weapons can be, why that is the line in the sand, the red line, the game changer, after something like 70,000 people have been killed in Syria over the last 2 years.
Absolutely. That's a very, very good point, because, quite frankly, most people have been killed in Syria by artillery fire or direct fire on the ground. It's been a very vicious civil war. So I agree with your point right there. I think part of the answer is that through the decades, there has been a taboo that's been established through the international community. There is a body of international law that oftentimes has not been used, particularly, you know, in the 1980s when Saddam Hussein used chemical weapons on Iran and the Kurds. So, but I think there's that additional taboo that's out there. And if I read the administration's policy on this, what they're trying to do here is look not only at what those military options might be, as Michael's great analysis examined, but also look at whether this can be used as diplomatic leverage to deal with the Russians and to build a broader coalition for a range of options on Syria.
Well, going back to you, Michael, first of all, is there anything you want to say in response to what Brian just said?
No, I think he outlined it. You know, this is obviously such a taboo because the last time was in Halabja in Iraq against the Kurds. So there is definitely you know, during the Iraq war, you know, Brian mentioned the use of chlorine gas. There was an attack in about 2006 where insurgents drove a chlorine gas truck across the border from either Syria or from Jordan and blew it up, and that kind of weaponized it. But it's very – I mean, chemical weapons are very hard to employ. So some of these reports just don't seem credible that – somehow insurgents threw this white powder and somehow this led to deaths. You kind of have to, you know, it's difficult to disperse chemical weapons for them to be effective. So, you know, the only other thing I would add here is that it's kind of interesting that Hezbollah has chosen this time to ramp up. Hassan Nasrallah basically said yesterday that there would be consequences if anything happened in Syria. So there is kind of an escalation here. So if the regime, whether wittingly or unwittingly, use these weapons, it's kind of curious the timing of Hezbollah to say that there will be consequences.
Going back to what you said earlier, though, I mean, it sounds like what you are saying is that because President Obama talked about a red line, a game changer, and if events prove that the Assad regime has used chemical weapons, that the U.S. has to do something. We can't do what we have been doing so far.
Yeah. So – yeah, I think that there has to be at least something visible. I'm not really a big proponent of sort of using force as a signal in international politics, but I think this might be kind of the exception that proves the rule for that. That there are audiences in Pyongyang, in Tehran, in Tel Aviv, in Jerusalem, that we do really need. If this was a limited case, if we start to arm the rebels, then I think there probably needs to be some kind of symbolic use of force, whether it's, you know, like President Clinton used in 1993 when he took office against the Iraqi intelligence services.
If we
launched a cruise missile or something and say that this is a warning shot, you know, try to limit collateral damage as much as we can. but really need to tell the regime that there's going to be consequences if they kind of countenance the use of these weapons
but
in the conflict.
It also sounds like you're saying a message to other countries
yes.
as well that we mean what we say.
Yes.
Brian, what do you think of that?
I think given that there's this public articulation of a red line, it will be difficult for the Obama administration just to continue on its current course. What I've seen, though, is that it's been constantly evaluating the situation. It's asked the Pentagon to prepare a range of options from airstrikes to no-fly zones to even commando raids. And yesterday, General Martin Dempsey, who's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the president's top military advisor, expressed skepticism about many of these options, especially the no-fly zones. So, and his skepticism was grounded in, will this actually, beyond sending a signal, will it actually contribute to greater stability and will it lessen the possibility of violence? And I think when you look at how linked Syria is to its immediate region, I understand the caution here because even if a small direct U.S. military intervention is undertaken here, you could have blowback from Hezbollah, as Michael mentioned, that they're engaged here. You have Israel right next door. And I was in Israel last month for a couple of weeks. And quite frankly, I think the Israelis are deeply concerned, but they're also not very keen on moving quickly. They themselves have conducted targeted strikes inside of Syria that have been reported. And but they don't, you know, they're not clamoring for a major U.S. military intervention here because everybody fears what would then come next.
Mm. Well, just picking up on that, Brian, and going back to you, the U.S. has been providing non-lethal aid to the opposition. And how do you understand what the opposition is? I heard an interview yesterday on Fresh Air, a New York Times reporter talking about just how amorphous the opposition can be in terms of who is there, why they're there, who are they allied with, what are they fighting for?
Yeah, it's very hard to briefly describe what's going on here, but basically there's two overarching organizations. There's the National Coalition of Syrian Opposition and Revolutionary Forces, which is a body that was formed in November of last year, which is the political opposition. And when, say, Secretary Kerry or other U.S. officials meet with these individuals at conferences, that's who we're talking about. There has been established a military branch called the Supreme Joint Military Command. And when you look at the various armed groups, some but not all of them are in this umbrella organization. You know, 260 rebel commanders participated in its foundation, but it includes groups like the Free Syrian Army, like the Syrian Liberation Front, and the Syrian Islamic Front. And it's, you know, they all have different strands. They all have different territories that they control. And then it also, the opposition includes this Nusra Front, Jabhat al-Nusra, which is a terrorist group classified by the United States. And it has several thousand fighters and has pledged loyalty to al-Qaeda. So it's a very combustible and amorphous mix of who we're actually trying to work with on the opposition side.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking about a very important issue in this hour of Radio Times, the conflict in Syria, the options before the U.S., something the president talked about yesterday. Brian Katulis, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, and Michael Noonan, director of the Foreign Policy Research Institute's Program on National Security, are our guests. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
1812 Productions, Philadelphia's all-comedy theater company, supports WHYY. Now on stage, It's My Party, the Women in Comedy Project, a world premiere comedy written and directed by Jennifer Childs. Featuring an eclectic cast of Philadelphia actresses, It's My Party, the Women and Comedy Project dives into the many roles comedy plays in women's lives, exploring and exposing the real comedy of everyday life. Tickets and information at 1812productions.org.
I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for listening to Radio Times. We're glad you enjoy what we do every day here at WHYY. If you're a member, a supporter, thanks for taking that next step to ensure that this live and long-form kind of program stays strong and healthy. If you haven't made a pledge of support, now is the time to do it. It's the spring membership campaign when each and every call is counted towards our overall goal to ensure that WHYY and all we do is in good shape. Here's that phone number. You probably know it by now, 1-888-345-9499, or the email address. You can pledge online at whyy.org. I promise you, you'll feel good about your pledge. You know where the money is going to because you are listening to it. Programs like Radio Times, Fresh Air, Morning Edition, All Things Considered. Today on Radio Times, U.S. policy and Syria, responding to President Obama's news conference yesterday, and then good stuff on TV. So make that call and make it now. Thanks very much. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Brian Katulis and Michael Noonan about what is going on in Syria and the options before the U.S. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Michael, let me go back to you and this question about arming the rebel forces or not, and exactly who the rebel forces are and what are they fighting for. This is also a region of the world that is pretty much awash with weapons. We know that there are weapons coming to the rebel forces without the U.S. involvement. Where are they coming from?
Well, some of the weapons are coming from the Gulf states. There's been some photographic evidence of shipping containers from Ukraine of some light weapons that are then coming through. So, as Brian said before, you know, one of the main groups is the Salafist group Jabhat al-Nusra. There's also another group, the Al-Faruq Brigades, that were formed in Homs. So, you know, during the Iraq War, both Hafez al-Assad and his son basically allowed Syrian territory to be a transit area to smuggle fighters and weapons into Iraq. And seemingly what's happened is – so there's about four or five different liberated zones right now that the rebels control. And one of them happens to be over next to Anbar province across from Qaim and sort of the Euphrates Valley. So one of the issues now is that al-Qaeda in Iraq, which was a problem during our war in Iraq – has come back, and the regime in Baghdad has been fighting them. So this is kind of one of the ironies of international politics that the Assad regimes basically allowed their territory to be used in this way, and now basically all these rat lines that were used to smuggle fighters and weapons into Syria are now being used against it by the rebels. So some of the Gulf regimes are foreign fighters, people from as far away as Libya, the Gulf states, and elsewhere that are kind of, you know, roving jihadis that are fighting there. It's very difficult to sort of disaggregate who exactly is within this rebel army. There are people that are probably we'd be fine with and control, and there's obviously people like Jabhat al-Nusra that we would not be happy with.
Let me go back to you, Brian, and perhaps this is with the advantage of hindsight, but do you think the U.S. is late to this game, that if there were things we had done 2 years ago when this began to evolve and devolve, that we would be in a better position, not just this country, but maybe even Syria?
I doubt it, just because so much of what is being what's happening on the ground, I think, is going to be shaped by the actors themselves. And I think the real important trend, and Michael was starting to talk about this when he talked about the different strands of the opposition group. You know, what's interesting is that Syria, the government before this conflict, had a fairly sizable military. Most estimates place it at 500,000, with about 180,000 active duty and the rest reserves. Now, because of defections, desertions, casualties, attrition, there are very vague estimates about what's going on right now, but it's much smaller and perhaps as low as below 100,000 in terms of – well, these, again, are very bad estimates because nobody has – and there are irregular fighters that are known in Arabic as Shabiha. So what's interesting is the groups that both Michael and I talked about on the opposition side, the Free Syrian Army and others, again, these are estimates, now place it around 100,000 or so. And these are just estimates in their various groups. But in terms of order of battle, I'm not, you know, a military analyst myself, but I'm a look at the region. And if you see what's going on and you see the attrition of the Syrian forces from the government, but then also the incoherence amongst the opposition and the armed opposition, the thing that I worry about is even if Assad were to go tomorrow, what you could see is the continued fracturing and fragmentation and, for lack of a better word, the militarization of the country into different zones if you don't have greater coherence among the opposition armed forces. And I think that's one thing that I think we may have, to answer your question, we may have been able to do a little bit more of. But quite frankly, a lot of this is being driven by the actors on the ground.
Well, Brian, one of the things that you have said is that the U.S. should go to the United Nations. We should involve NATO, that this is something that the U.S. should not do by itself.
Well, we are doing that. And in fact, if you look at what the Obama administration quietly, I think, has been doing over the last couple of weeks, there have been a steady stream of visitors from the Arab world. Most recently, Jordan's King Abdullah, who Jordan is a close ally of ours, but a number of the Gulf countries that are, quite frankly, arming a lot of the opposition. Mm-hmm. Turkey, because it's a NATO ally and because it has its longest Syria's longest borders with Turkey. What I see is, again, continued efforts to try to get people to move together in concert. I think the toughest nut to crack will be Russia. President Obama indicated that he's sending Secretary of State Kerry to Russia again. And I think, and this is, again, this is my analysis, I think what they're doing with their public messaging here on the chemical weapons accusations is to try to, again, lean on the Russians to get them to move off of their support of Syria. I wouldn't hold our breath in getting the Russians to move, though.
I want to find out where you stand on that issue, whether you think the U.S. can pressure Russia in some way to pressure Assad, Michael.
That's the kind of million-dollar question right now. I would doubt it, only because, you know, Russia maintains a naval facility along the coast, which is where the Alawite community and where the most supporters for the regime are. And I think Russia will want to kind of continue to stand up. I mean, their reaction, for instance, to these two, the brothers Darnayev, and their response there has certainly been to sort of, you know, externalize any blame for that situation.
The U.S. doesn't have leverage with Putin, you
don't think? I don't think so. No. I mean, Putin right now, he might, you know, there's been discussion that we can maybe resolve this situation, but who knows if this is a delaying tactic or if there's some real, you know, a real serious undertone to those discussions.
Brian, I mean, is Russia our frenemy, as has been described?
They're our frenemy, but on this, and again, why I say I wouldn't hold our breath, is that in addition to what Michael said about Russian naval bases in Syria, Russia has supported Syria and its air defenses. So the air defense system that you would need to take down to employ and implement a no-fly zone are quite sophisticated. So Syria is not like Libya because of the Russian support there. But then I would add to it, Russia has a general stance, particularly after our intervention in Libya, of non-intervention directly. And they see this for their own reasons, because of some of their own perceived threats inside of their own borders. And this has come up before in the Kosovo conflict and other things. But I'd watch Russia again. I don't think it's completely hopeless, because I think Russia at the end of the day is probably pragmatic, and they see that in the long run, Assad's regime probably doesn't have much of a long shelf life in Syria.
And that's Brian Katulis, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, joining us here in our Philadelphia studios, Michael Noonan. And he's the director of the Foreign Policy Research Institute's Program on National Security. And we are talking about a very important issue that came up yesterday in President Obama's press conference, essentially what the U.S. should or possibly shouldn't do when it comes to the civil war in Syria, and questions about whether it makes sense to arm the rebel forces or not, when and how or whether to intervene. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Brian, I noticed a recent poll by the New York Times and a broadcast organization looking at the American public, and I guess not surprisingly, there's not a lot of support for U.S. intervention in Syria.
Yeah, it's fairly low. And again, I worry about this in the context of a broader trend in U.S. society where it's not isolationism, but I think there is this retrenchment. When you look at our own political debates, you see what's happening on Capitol Hill. I do think that there's this inattention to foreign affairs writ large, let alone Syria. I understand, again, the caution and the pragmatism, because we just got out of a war in Iraq, which was disastrous for U.S. national security interests. We're trying to close down and finish a war in Afghanistan, which has not achieved very great results. So I understand that, but I think the Obama administration in the United States is going to need to continue to play this role that they have on issues like Syria, of trying to get others to pull their weight, try to get us to actually help with things like making the Syrian opposition more cohesive. So U.S. leadership I do see as essential. And I think that is the bigger, longer-term worrisome trend, is that is there enough appetite amongst the American public for the U.S. leadership role in the world?
Well, and adding two other countries to the two that you mentioned, Brian, Libya and Egypt, since the Arab Spring, two countries that the U.S. got involved in to some degree, and you look at what's happening in those countries, and it's very troublesome.
Well, yeah, I think the whole Middle East is, when you look at the demographic, the economic, political pressures that the Middle East is facing, what we saw begin in 2011 in these countries is just the start, and it's probably going to go on for years, and we probably won't have much clarity until the end of this decade. If you look at the fact that 60% of the populations in most of these countries is under the age of 25, and they have these crushing demands. So I think if you think the last 2 years have been complicated in this part of the world, it's only going to actually get more complex.
Well, tossing this back to you, Michael, I mean, it seems that in many ways the choices, if the U.S. has one, are bad choices, worse choices, and even worse choices than that.
Yeah, there's no good options here. There's no magic bullet that's going to make this problem go away. And then you have to think about, too, the wider geopolitics of the region. We have about 200 soldiers from the 1st Armored Division right now in Jordan, helping the Jordanian government on the humanitarian side, providing assistance. Jordan right now may have as many as 1 million refugees from Syria. And in a country of about 6.5 million people, that's troublesome depending on the beliefs of these people. King Abdullah II is not terribly popular right now. So we could have real catastrophic success here, even if the Assad regime falls and an Islamist friendly government takes over. There could be problems in the broader region and could reignite. I mean, there's right now tensions between Sunni and Shia are heating up in Iraq. This is a real powder keg. So I don't want anybody to misconstrue what I'm saying here, that I think that there's, we'll just simply, intervene and everything will be good. Mm-hmm. I do, however, question, the Air Force always kind of puts up this this slow roll that we have to take down the air defense network. Well, the Israelis hit a nuclear power plant, a nuclear reactor up in northern Syria a few years ago. So obviously they don't have a lot of the high-tech systems that we do. So I think there might be other options available to send messages. Whether that does anything productive in the long term, I don't know. But I think it at least will send a message about chemical weapons use.
And do you think that would be effective, Brian, based on what you know about this region?
We just don't know. And I know a lot about this region. I'm going to Jordan next week. And I think the what then questions that the president and probably his inner circle and people like the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff ask, because I think the things that they look at, number one, would even a pinprick strike accelerate the conflict in some sort of way? Would it cause a reaction from the terrorist group Hezbollah to act in some sort of way? Would it actually spill over back into Israel, which is very, very nervous about what's going on in Syria and deeply concerned about the threat from southern Lebanon? And then add to it the complications of the Kurdish groups that are inside of Syria and Iraq. About 10% of Syrians are of Kurdish background. And one of the reasons for Turkey's hesitation for full-blown intervention or even limited strikes of the sort that we've been talking about has been, well, what sort of reaction would this cause? So I don't know. It may end up sending a signal, but it also potentially could light the fire that leads to not just a civil war inside of Syria, but a regional war.
Wow. Do you think, though, Brian, I'm asking you, I guess, to get inside the head of President Assad, but do you think from his calculations he believes he is winning this conflict and can win it, can defeat these forces fighting against him?
he seems to posture as so. And again, I think even though his forces have been there's been attrition and they've suffered a lot of losses, he seems to continue to act in that fashion. Mm-hmm. The way I read it, though, just independently, is that it looks like what we have on the ground is a stalemate. And even no matter if there's additional U.S. resources and even arming of the rebels, it looks like we've hit some sort of stalemate and there's a de facto partition of the country, effectively, with rebel groups controlling some parts of the country and the Syrian government continuing to hold on. And I think his grip is much more cohesive than Muammar Gaddafi's grip in Libya is, in part because of the tight networks that have been built up over the decades inside of their security forces.
Let me see what looks like Eugene from Sicklerville, New Jersey has to say. Eugene, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm wondering why it's automatically assumed that the U.S. has a responsibility every time a group of insurgents in any country strikes out against their government to take the responsibility for walking in and helping the insurgents when we can't feed and clothe our people over here. We have a sequester. We can't support treatment for our cancer patients. You know, I don't know why we are advocating the neocon view that the entire world is the American oyster in responsibility.
Well, Eugene, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me toss that to you, Michael. I mean, we don't intervene everywhere for every group, but I think nonetheless, Eugene has a point.
Yeah.
Which is why this, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I think why this is probably, you know, the geopolitical reason that Syria is in a very key region of the world where a lot of bad things can happen if the wrong outcome occurs there. So while I sympathize with the caller's views, sometimes the United States has a responsibility to act. I don't think that makes it necessarily a neocon view, but we have key regional interests there, and I think that as long as we don't want that to, if we don't act, maybe it does boil over into a regional war, or boil over into a regional war, which would then have much worse consequences.
Brian, this has been the opposite critique about a minute before a second break here, which is that the U.S. has not intervened, has not done enough to help not just the rebel forces, but all the people that have been displaced and have become refugees either inside of Syria or to neighboring nations.
That's right. And just briefly, I think the president has been wise in having this measured and very cautious response because fundamentally we want to get others to pull their weight, and particularly those countries in the region. And I think that's part of his formula here. Some read that as a weakness or of leading from behind. I see it as expanding the zone of responsibility of who can actually do more here. And I think, yes, we can do more, but others should do as well.
And that's Brian Katulis. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. His work focuses on U.S. national security policy in the Middle East and South Asia. Michael Noonan with us in our Philadelphia studios, director of the Foreign Policy Research Institute's program on national security. And his work focuses on civil military relations, defense organizations, missions, counterinsurgency, the military's role in combating terrorism. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. What do you think the U.S. should do about Syria? Give us a call, 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. Fox Chase offers lung screening for individuals at high risk of lung cancer, based on results of a national trial which showed death from lung cancer was reduced by 20% with early detection. Qualified candidates receive a low-dose CT scan and an appointment with an advanced practice clinician to discuss the results that same day. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center, now part of Temple Health.
Okay, here's a reality check. WHYY gets more than half of our funding from listeners just like you who tune to the radio or our websites to stay informed and be connected to our fast-changing world. We spend about 1% of our broadcast time every year raising money through our membership campaigns. That means that almost 99% of what you hear our programs produce here at WHYY, like Radio Times, Fresh Air, Newsworks Tonight, Voices in the Family, and of course programs from NPR like Morning Edition and All Things Considered, all that costs money. So make a pledge right now at 1-888-345-9499, and you can pledge online at WHYY.org. Today on Radio Times, we're discussing a very important issue, what the U.S. should do about the civil war in Syria. Then we borrowed David Bianculli, Fresh Air's TV critic, to talk about all the good stuff on TV. We do everything here on Radio Times. Make a pledge, 1-888-345-9499. Thanks. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with Brian Katulis and Michael Noonan about what it means to cross a red line when it comes to U.S. foreign policy, what options are available to the U.S. and the international community to help end the conflict in Syria, which has resulted in the deaths of something like 70,000 people, many of them civilians, and of course, threatening to create turmoil in this region of the world. We are taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And we want to know what you think the U.S. should do. Michael, I want to go back to something that actually you and I were talking about off the air, looking at this poll of the American public about where it stands on U.S. involvement in Syria. Although the American public doesn't want the U.S. to send in the military, they don't seem to mind the use of drones.
Yeah, about 70% of the public polled in this New York Times CBS poll said that they were comfortable with the use of drones. So I think that my late boss at FPRI, Harvey Sickerman, used to talk about the cheap hawk impulse in American politics where kind of you want to be seen to be doing something, but at sort of a low cost. And I think that in the case of, you know, in the case of drones, I think there's a legitimate use for them. If you're talking about a place like Western Pakistan, the tribal areas, you know, there's really no other way to sort of disrupt the Al-Qaeda and the Taliban networks there, or a place like Yemen where you don't want to get embroiled on the ground. I would like to go back, if I can, for a moment to talk about something Brian talked about at the end of his. And I agree that we should really try to get more burden sharing in the region from neighbors to help with this, and the Europeans as well. But sometimes, you know, the leading from behind, while I think is the right approach, or should be the right approach, sometimes it has unintended consequences.
Such as
in Libya, for instance, where, you know, we have this problem in Mali now, largely because Gaddafi had Tuareg mercenaries working for him. And once the regime fell, they took heavy weapons and went back to Niger and into Mali and then started to cause problems. Just because somebody else is going to lift the burden, we might not be happy with the result. And that's why, you know, obviously we should be involved somehow to help try to shape the outcome, if it's even shapeable. And, you know, in this case, it might not be. You know, like we said before, there's maybe all the options here are bad, but you probably want to try to get the least bad option that you can. And being involved is the only way really to ensure that's the case sometimes.
Brian, going back to you, though, and even looking at your prescription, if I can call it that, the idea that if you could get the region involved and some of the U.S. allies involved, is there a place, is there room for diplomacy, or are we beyond that?
I think there's room for diplomacy. I mean, look, the region's already involved. The world is already involved, and the U.S. has already intervened here in the sense that we're offering assistance to the rebels. We're deeply engaged already. The question of diplomacy, I think the toughest part is whether Assad really wants to engage in a political negotiation. Lakhdar Brahimi, who is the senior UN United Nations diplomat engaged in this, he's been working on this after Kofi Annan, the former head of the UN, tried to work on this. Right. And you've had very senior people engage in diplomacy, and it's the resilience, you know, the fact that Assad is not willing to genuinely engage. And at the same time, you have some elements of the rebels who don't want a political negotiation right now. So it's a complicated issue. But I would say, you know, I agree with a lot of what Michael said in terms of leadership there and in the region. But we also need to be careful about how we actually not overextend ourselves in the way that we did, I think, in the first decade of the century. And I think that's why we've seen this step-by-step approach by the Obama administration.
But do you think, Brian, that there are people around Assad who could either pressure him or maybe even overthrow him?
They've tried, again. And even if that were to happen, these discussions, if they got to Assad and his family to leave, it still leaves us with this question of a country that has now descended into fragmentation, into different competing militias that have already been armed by actors in the region that are already getting support from some of the most radical Islamist groups. So even if Assad and some of his inner circle step down, it leaves you with the continued problems of everything else that we've been talking about with the threats inside of Syria and the possibility that that hits and impacts countries in the region.
Let me see what Sean from Gladwin has to say. Sean, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi
there.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
I normally love your show. Today I'm feeling like I need more specifics to understand the conversation so that I can be a member of the American public that weighs in intelligently. But I feel like I watch the news sometimes and they never put a map up, and I feel like I'm out of the loop. So I just wondered if your speakers could be a little more specific today about just which countries around Syria are the ones who would be impacted if we don't intervene anymore, and what economic interests or military interests, you know, what bases do we have near there that are going to be impacted by this? Because I've got, you know, relatives who are former military folks, and I come from an area in Virginia that's got a lot of military people, and so I want to be informed, but I'm hearing a lot of political speak and not a whole lot of specifics that would educate me, and I really want that from a public radio people.
Well, I appreciate that. And, you know, on radio, Sean, we can't do maps, but we can certainly talk about the region. Let me toss that to you, Michael. Do you want to, just in terms of the region that we're talking about?
Yeah, so Syria, if you think of Turkey, you know, it's to the south of Turkey, to the east of Iraq, to the north of Jordan, to the north – northeast of Israel, and then basically to the east, north and east of Lebanon. So American bases in the region, we have Incirlik Air Base in Turkey, which is a key installation. The consequences, though, your question, I think Brian touched on this a bit before. The Turkish government, it seems, is engaging with Kurds. So I'm not sure, you know, maybe there's some kind of grand deal that could be struck here with the Turks and the Kurds, where they give them some autonomy. They allow this sort of the northeastern part of Syria is a Kurdish area. Maybe that gets some kind of autonomy or links up with the Kurds in northern Iraq. But there could be spillover. Like I said, there's already spillover in Iraq right now. You have clashes between the Shia government and Sunnis there. Jordan is obviously sitting kind of on a demographic precipice right now. A population of about 6.5 million. King Abdullah II, a key U.S. ally, his regime could be at stake, particularly if an Islamist group comes out on top in Syria. Israel still occupies the Golan Heights, which is, you know, key strategic high ground in the area, where, you know, a broader war could spill out. We talked before about Hezbollah.
So no easy or even rosy picture here.
I mean, there's really some nightmarish scenarios that could spiral out of this.
Yeah, Sean, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me get to Deborah from Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. And Deborah, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you. Thank you for taking my question.
Sure.
I'm a scholar of the Middle East, a political scientist, and so I've watched very carefully U.S. foreign policy with regards to Iraq, Afghanistan, and Libya. And so given our discussion of the horrible civilian casualties, the destabilizing effects of large refugee flows into other countries, why are we not hearing discussion about protecting people, protecting civilians, if it's no-fly zones or the use of air power to protect?
It's a good question, and I'm going to toss that to you, Brian Gatulis.
There has been discussion of this, and I think it's a very important question. Few people know that more people have died in Syria in the last 2 years than have died in Iraq and Afghanistan combined. That's how deadly Syria has been. And the discussion on no-fly zones, I mentioned briefly that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Martin Dempsey, yesterday talked about this. And you can certainly, we could do it. You could implement a no-fly zone, but you'd have to control the air defense systems of Syria, which again get support from Russia. You can't simply just penetrate it. You have to control it. The question of no-fly zones doesn't answer the question of, though, how do you actually prevent deaths? Because only 10% of the casualties in the conflict are from the air. So a no-fly zone doesn't get you much in terms of a reduction in violence. 90% of those casualties come from direct fire on the ground or artillery. So it's, I think, an important option to consider. As I understand it, our military is considering it and weighing it against everything else we have to do in the region. But I also think there are other ways of trying to help protect civilians. Are there ways to create more safe zones in places like Jordan and Turkey where people can come out? And I think we need more creativity here. And I think the question is spot on. How do we actually reduce the civilian casualties?
Indeed. Deborah, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let's see what Joe from Easton has to say. And Joe, you are on Radio Times. Go ahead.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
At the beginning of the conflict, it seemed that it was people from Syria that were concerned about what their government was doing or not doing. And then as time grew, developed, they became a little more militant. Now you have people coming from all over the globe to fight as to help the rebels, people that weren't even from Syria. And I'm concerned that their goals are totally different than what the original people that were rebelling against the government, where there are grievances against the government, and even though the government never addressed that, now it's become something much more, and it looks like the United States is actually aiding and abetting these fundamentalist guerrillas that are coming in the fight, and it just seems against everything that we're fighting for in the world at this point, and I just want you to comment on that,
sure.
Please.
No, Joe, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Michael, I'm back at you.
Okay. Well, I mean, in Syria, you had a place, it's kind of the reverse situation of Iraq. You had a small minority, the Alawites, who are basically an offshoot of Shia Islam. Most Shia Muslims are what they call 12ers. Alawites are 11ers. So they were in control of the regime, and they had to ally themselves with some minority groups there against the majority Sunni population and then try to work divides within the Sunni population amongst the Kurds and amongst the Arabs there and other groups. So one of the big things of these Salafist groups like Jabhat al-Nusra is that they believe that the Shia are apostates and they should fight them wherever they can. So this makes obviously Syria a very attractive target for them.
But it seems like the tricky thing for the U.S. And perhaps our allies is trying to figure out how to separate out those who have come to Syria to fight a different kind of fight and those who are challenging the government.
Yeah, I mean, that's been the reports all along, that the CIA has been trying to find people that we can work with and trying to disaggregate them from the bad folks that are coming. You also have sort of Muslim Brotherhood people within Syria. So it's not really helpful to look at the sort of Islamist groups as a homogenous piece. Mm. There are many different factions within with many different motivations, and so I wouldn't lump them all together.
Joe, thanks for the call to Radio Times, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Brian, anything you want to say to Joe's comment?
Well, it's an important point. And I think what we've seen over the last year particularly are these groups from the region flooding the zone inside of Syria and basically hijacking what was initially a peaceful revolution against the regime that was not respecting the rights of its own citizens. And now it's becoming a much more regional dynamic, which makes it all the more the caution and the sort of step-by-step approach by Obama, I think, makes that argument even stronger. Because if we go in and we inadvertently end up supporting or indirectly offering support to some of these rebel groups that are radical Islamists, then we end up undermining our long-term interests. We saw that happen in the 1980s in Afghanistan, for instance, and we're still dealing with those implications 30 years later.
But, Brian, and we're almost out of time here, but I'm wondering, you know, if Putin said to Assad, you know, come and live in Russia, and you can spend the rest of your life here, and you have Syria without Assad in power, what would prevent that country from just falling apart even more?
I think the thing that would prevent it is, number one, can you have cohesion of the Syrian security forces and some sort of coordination with them and the rebel forces? If Assad's gone, can you execute a transition that isn't like what we did in Iraq, which was dismiss the army, but keep the building blocks of stability there? And that, I think, is a very difficult thing with the different militias. But I think that's essential. And then the political negotiation, all of the work that the U.S. diplomats and others have been doing to try to build cohesion within the Syrian political opposition, all of that groundwork, which has been essential, I think, would then become even more relevant.
And, Michael, we have about 30 seconds. What's your, I guess, vision for a post-Assad Syria?
Well, I mean, post-Assad Syria, you know, hopefully
it's hard to imagine, maybe.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine, but it would have to be a place where the Alawites and the Christians felt safe living in Syria. And that's the key question. You know, what kind of government takes power and how much revenge they want to seek on the former regime. And the Alawites are pretty concentrated along the coast. So it's difficult to see if that kind of, some kind of settled negotiation can happen there, where they'll be able to stay behind.
Well, I realize there is much more to discuss. My thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Michael Katulis, thank you. Oh, excuse me, Brian Katulis. I just kind of married you two here.
All right.
Brian Katulis, thank you very much for joining us from the studios of the Center for American Progress, where he's a senior fellow. And Michael Noonan, thank you very much as well. And he's director of the Foreign Policy Research Institute's Program on National Security, which is headquartered here in Philadelphia. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour. Stay with us. We'll be right back.